Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, I take what you pay, but I got to put you down for a while. Well, you know I can't quit you, babe, but I got to put you down for a while.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back once more to Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio. I am Patrick Connor of Knuckles and Gloves, also the Fight City, a couple other places, boxing history accounts and whatnots. But today we are here to talk about the recent kind of rash of boxing that we had this past weekend that was it's fairly potent. It wasn't bad. It wasn't the greatest time on the face of the planet, but it was good. It was pretty good, especially when you take into consideration that it was a bunch of quantity. Wasn't the quality we had hoped, but that's fine. We can deal with it. That being said, in just a minute, I'm going to be having on my buddy Bryn Jonathan Butler, author, filmmaker, trainer to the stars, I like to say. Good dude, and we're going to be getting into all of this stuff over the course of the next maybe hour or so. But there's also been some recent developments in boxing news that hopefully I'll try to slide in there, like, for instance, the potential confirmation of a Deontay Wilder versus Luis Ortiz fight coming up in the next couple of months. That's pretty big for the heavyweight division, and that's fairly big news for boxing, and especially for a 2017 that has already been pretty damn good. So we're just kind of building and building and building here, hopefully this fall. And, you know, fall tends to be when a lot of the big fights or the bigger fights happen. So considering 2017's been so big already, I don't know. This could get pretty good. That being said, Bryn, my friend, how are you?
I'm still recovering from the press conference in Brooklyn.
You survived it.
It's like 7 hours of fucking sitting around. Yes, I did. How are you?
I'm not doing bad at all. I mean, I'm not going to lie. I basically have been catching like the quote unquote important clips from these press conferences, these Mayweather McGregor press conferences. And I'm just not going to be wasting my time unless I'm getting paid to write some shit or something like that about it. I'm not going to be wasting my time watching it.
I mean, who's left to offend at this point? Like how much further do you have to stoop to appeal to the absolute lowest common denominator to sell this thing? I mean, to be honest, like, I stayed for, I don't know, 6 hours or something, and at the end there's like the private meeting with the fighters, and McGregor came in and talked to us for a little while. I left before Mayweather showed up. I was just so bored out of my mind.
Oh, geez, man. Well, what's left to hear? What's left for them to say? Like, what's new?
No, it's just like third-rate 1980s wrestling theater. Like, there's no wink to it. It's like they actually believe it. I don't know. Like, there was something kind of almost reassuring about the WWF version of it, and this just feels not even like it harkens back to something nostalgic. Like it's a harbinger for some really awful, scary shit that's 10 or 20 years down the road. Like if this gets 13,000 people into like the Barclays Center in Brooklyn and in London and in LA, like what's the next promoter, the next Don King in prison right now saying, fuck, if these guys can sell this shit, I've got an idea for you, you know, prison row inmates, whatever. Like, I don't know. Like, it was just so boring and embarrassing and degrading. Like, I know that's like that's the popular narrative of like anybody over the age of 30 writing about this, and I'm not writing about this, but I'm amazed that like there's a major boxing event where I feel relief not to cover it. Like, I wouldn't go to this thing. I mean, as you say, like if they pay me, I'll go. But I don't, not even do I not want to watch the fight. I don't want to be in the soup of this fight. I don't want to marinate in this. Like, it was just to see it up close and the guys walk up to the red carpet and do this really cheesy roast of one another. I don't know that I've ever been to a fight like we're just like the lead up to a fight where I was just felt dirty. Like, and I mean, this is boxing. Like, I mean, I've seen some pretty ridiculous shit, including Mayweather Pacquiao, but that wasn't ugly. Like, it, you felt like, okay, there's a predictable route that this is going to go, which it did, but that's a mismatch. This is a freak show, and I don't particularly want to watch, like, I don't know, some kind of medieval public spectacle of chucking tomatoes at somebody who's, you know, in one of those wooden vices, you know, where their head and their hands are all clamped in. Like, there's just something about it that just feels really ugly.
I believe those were called stocks, if I'm not mistaken. But that being said, I mean, it's that's it. You got it. You nailed it. It's, I don't think I've heard really anybody, apart from the people involved, talking about this event as if it's something good, something positive, something more than what it is. Like, you know, anything more than kind of a circus or a sideshow, or, you know, I don't just want to jump on the bandwagon of all of the, like you say, kind of like older generation people or people over 30 or whatever who are just kind of viewing this as some kind of massive joke that we can't handle. But it kind of is that, and I just don't really, it's really tough to kind of like take it seriously. I don't really hear anybody speaking about it as if it's anything more than something they just need to see or be part of because they want to be part of something popular. That's why people went to the press conferences. They want to say they went. Everyone's taking photos of their tickets, putting it on Instagram. Here's my press pass. Hey, Mayweather McGregor press pass, fucking Instagram, boom. You know, it's like, that's literally all of this. That's what all of this is. Just like Mayweather Pacquiao, where it's kind of just everybody, and I was guilty of it too. I'm not going to, you know, try to magically erase myself out of that or anything. I kind of got swept up in it too. I'm not going to lie. It was big, and I totally understand that mob mentality or that kind of desire to want to cling on to something popular and this huge in history, but it's just kind of false. It's not a lasting thing in a positive way.
No, I mean, the closest thing that I can feel, like just what you're describing, that confluence of buzz and like, this is going to be awful, was like the Star Wars prequels. You know, which my brothers, who are quite a bit older than me, like, they went to the originals. They remember that organically just exploding, where just that tidal wave of excitement is building, and then you go in and see it, and you have to go back again and again and again, and everybody you know has gone again and again and again. And it just gets more and more fun to share it. And this was like the Star Wars prequels, where there was so much of a buildup, like, ah, this will be ours. This is going to be so nice to tap into that and bring generations together. And it was just fucking cynical, awful garbage. Like, it was just so cheap. And this was similar. Like McGregor is just doing this third-rate, ravishing Rick Rude routine, like in spandex, his shirt's off. He's talking about what kind of shape he's in, as if that has any bearing on his competitiveness in this thing. And Mayweather just sits there, you know, on his phone. He's on his phone the whole time.
Yeah.
With his daughter. And afterwards, I don't remember if it was Brooklyn or the one previous, like LA, he's like laying into McGregor, how could you disrespect me and in front of the mother of my child and my daughter? And this is a guy who was threatening to beat to death the mother of his child in front of his child, who actually had to run away to call the police to save his mother's life, and he's taking the moral high ground on social media. against this, you know, these kind of theatrics. Like, I'm like, what the fuck am I looking? I kept looking around because, like, they were maybe 15 feet in front of me as they walked on to the red carpet thing at center stage. You couldn't hear anything. Like, the sound system was awful. Everything was just muddled, like you were at, like, a Greyhound bus station. I mean, Greyhound bus stations, I know what they're calling. This bus is going here, this bus is going there. It wasn't even that good. I had no idea what – none of us did, what the announcer was saying, what they were saying. And I'm looking around at different writers that I know from other events. Like, Greg Bishop is there from Sports Illustrated. He's just flown in on the plane, and I'm asking about it. And all he could say was, like, McGregor actually believes he's going to win. As if it makes a difference. Like, as if it makes any difference whatsoever.
Yeah,
you know,
every fighter believes they're going to win.
Yeah, and guess what? It doesn't
Yet
matter.
Everyone has a loser. Yeah, every fight has two fighters that believe they're going to win, yet almost every single one has a loser. That has nothing to do with anything, you know?
Well, and see, the ultimate takeaway for me is that neither of these guys, as you say, I think the difference to that calculus that you just described is the loser is us. That's what's changed in boxing, is it doesn't matter who loses these fights. They're guaranteed winners for everybody involved. The guaranteed loser, like a sucker playing some stupid game in a casino, playing the slot, is you're the loser. You're the loser for participating. And that's the entire way that this has been calibrated in terms of the marketing and the event. If you're stupid enough to buy this shit, if you're stupid enough to endorse more of this kind of thing happening, because I really feel now like this is going to blow away the Mayweather-Pacquiao fight in terms of pay-per-view and buzz. I mean, you can get 13,000 people to see an event, a non-event, that's as boring as these guys were putting on, like just really cheesy, like fucking Apollo Theater stuff. Not even Apollo Theater, but like that kind of open mic stand-up where it's just like so vulgar, racist, misogynist. Like,
and
kids are there listening to this shit.
I have to say, you basically pegged it too, and I thought the exact same thing when I was watching clips last week before you had said it too, with the whole boy dance for me boy thing, and then, you know, it kind of pops up that a handful of other things were said, or, you know, things were kind of caught not on mic or kind of half on mic and stuff like that. That are, anyway, you basically pegged it last week with that stuff, and it's just, it's really is catering to like some pretty low denominators there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. The dance for me boy thing, I think he was on record for using monkey as a slur against Floyd. And then his rebuttal to being accused of being a racist or pandering to racism is, how could I be racist when, like, below the waist I'm black? And then he starts gyrating, ravishing Rick Rude style to the audience at Brooklyn. As if, like, that's his mea culpa. I was like, what am I watching here? I don't know. Like, I can really get in on some, like, pretty low-level art form. I mean, I can go on YouTube and watch, like, Frank Fark videos and laugh. But this, I was just not laughing. I just felt really, like, I went to see Planet of the Apes after it just to get, like, some kind of equilibrium, and then you're watching that film and all you do is root against humanity, and I was feeling really depressed after. I don't want to root against humanity, but the humanity that's in that film is the same one that I was watching basically, you know, 20 years before it comes to fruition in the Planet of the Apes ethos there at the Barclay Center. And you know, 5 million people are going to pay $100 probably to watch this thing, which is going to launch a lot of marketing people to say, wow, like, why bother with competitive anything if this is what people really want? We need to go a lot further because there's a lot more money to be made. Like, as I say, this is not a finish line in any sense. This is not the wave is not cresting. The wave is just starting. With what this has begun, and that's just it's scary. Like, it was really, that was my takeaways. I felt scared, like, not with what I was seeing, because it's still ridiculous, but it's not going to be ridiculous in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. Like, the continuum carried not very far into the future. This is going to go really, really, like, science fiction places, because if there's money to be made, rules, decency, all of those kind of touchstones that we've associated with, like, the poles are going to move dramatically to accommodate the money that can be made from this. If this is a commodity, beware where this is headed.
I mean, it's really just, I kind of said a very similar thing last week, and I don't want to get alarmist, because, as I've said before, swindling people, suckering people, circus-like events and bullshit in boxing, nothing new, really nothing new. In fact, that's kind of part of the foundation of the sport in some ways. But you can, you know, again, not to be one of the crusty history assholes here, but you can go back and you can pinpoint a number of these larger events in the history of boxing. You know, easy ones, super easy ones to name. Hagler, Hearns, you know, fucking among those, among Hagler, Hearns, Leonard, and Duran, you could pick just about any fight among them. And it works fine for this example here, but things got huge. There was a lot of buildup. There was a lot of hubbub and a big to-do about the fight and promotion, blah, blah, blah. The point was that there was substance to it. There was a reason why that fight was happening. It wasn't just something they made up out of thin air because it made money. And that's not, and I, again, I don't want to say like that is always the case in the history of boxing, and that's never the case now, because that's not true. We do have some great fights now and in this era. There were some shit fights then, and there were some absolute, you know, shit fests and things that shouldn't have happened and blah, blah, blah. But it's just that when you look at these big events and the things that they build up, overall, the trend, there is a trend, and it has changed. And it does worry me as far as where promoters potentially could take that. Because if they're literally making something out of nothing, they're taking a guy who has never fought before in a boxing ring as a professional. They might as well, like, take me. I mean, it's not, he's never fought before. And then we take another guy who's potentially the greatest fighter of this last generation, or one of the greatest fighters of this last generation. It makes no sense. So making this something out of nothing, like you said, hopefully is, I hope it's not a signal to other promoters that they could just start doing this type of shit out of nowhere just to make a quick buck. And I hope that that's not what the sport starts to lean toward. But, you know, when there's money to be made and the writing is kind of on the wall, it's sad. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, it made me think of something. Like, when I was a kid, the first, like, road trip I went on, I knew a guy at a boxing gym who was a Golden Glove champion. He was also a model. Like, he was just one of these guys that, you know, was extraordinarily popular in a lot of different realms that don't usually go together. And he suggested going down to Los Angeles from Vancouver. And along the way, I found out that the reason why he had so much money was not his modeling career, but it turned out he was a Hell's Angel who was doing grow ops and all this kind of thing. And I went, oh my God, I've been duped into potential, like, what's in the trunk, you know? Like, and there was this conversation along the way where he was talking about how anybody who was a working guy was just a sucker, because he was 24. He already bought a house, had a really nice car, just, and it was like a clear line of, and I think there was some kind of hope in his mind that wouldn't all of this appeal to me to join in? Like, it was so easy to get involved with this kind of thing. And I was just like, but then everything that you have, like, the substance of what you did to earn it is so, not just meaningless, but just destructive and vacuous. And there's something about a society where nobody cares how you get famous. And you keep hearing about the Kardashians brought up all the time. I mean, Kim Kardashian is one of the most famous people on earth. Trump is clearly using being president to validate that there is substance behind his legacy, but it's all about just being seen and
right.
Ratings is the obsession and that kind of thing. And
it's the idea that, well, since I'm here, I must deserve it.
Yeah. If I'm rich, who cares how I got rich? I must be moral. And if you're poor, you must be immoral. You must deserve it. There must be a negative reason justifying why you don't have it, because it's winner take all and that kind of thing. So you're seeing that, this event is so emblematic of that kind of mentality. And as you say, like the great fighters of the past that Floyd is self-appointedly saying, I'm better than all of them. They call me the best ever. Nobody called you the best ever. You call yourself the best ever. And the reason why is, how would you have done in the 1980s against those great fighters of that era? I think you would have certainly been competitive, but you wouldn't have been dominant.
Sure.
Against Sugar Ray
No.
Leonard. You wouldn't have been dominant against Tommy Hearns.
No.
Many fighters that I view as much better than Floyd. I mean, even Roy Jones Jr. told me that he used to spar with Sugar Ray Leonard, and he was like, I did fine. I wouldn't be worried if I was fighting in that era against Sugar Ray Leonard. I think I'd do okay. It would be Tommy Hearns that would scare me. That guy's physical
yeah.
dimensions. That's a real conversation of a guy who's Roy fucking Jones Jr. and how good he was at that time. I don't think he has any warped sense of how good he was. He knows how good he was, and he's still willing to concede. I'd be nervous about that matchup. On paper, that's a lot for me to overcome, that guy. Floyd just transcends all of that with this I don't even know if it's delusional or it's just cynical bullshit. I'm better than anybody because all you need to do is look at the cash register. It's the same kind of thing you heard with Tyson after prison. I must be the biggest ever because, like, look at the cash register. Look at how much money I'm getting for fighting Buster Mathis Jr., Peter McNeely, Frank Bruno, all of that. And it was – everybody knew he was nowhere near what he had been when he was a real fighter, leading up to and just after
yeah.
fighting Michael Spinks, where that guy scared the hell out of everybody, where even Muhammad Ali is saying, don't think he could have beat me. I know you're thinking it. I know you're thinking, oh, I had trouble with Joe Frazier and Tyson would have given me trouble. There's something about an event like this Mayweather thing with his legacy. – If he had come out of retirement here at 40 years old and fought Gennady Golovkin, I'd be like, this guy really does care about his legacy. This guy really wants to go out, get that 49-0 against a major fucking challenge. And on the strength of that being such a challenge, and could he do it, that would create such a positive, I think, energy, feeling nervous, like what's going to happen to Floyd if he loses? Golovkin is on his way to the biggest challenge of his career. It's an era-defining fight, and instead we get something like this, which means absolutely nothing. And there's no not moral hazard, but like there's no counterbalance to this.
Yes,
beyond
no deterrent.
Like old guys. Yeah, there's no. All there is like some old writers that nobody gives a shit about saying like, "Don't watch this. This is terrible." Like, so. You and I and our perspective on this, like, we're just on the sideline being like, what the fuck? But I am kind of amazed that there's nothing meaningful pushing back against this. Like, what, Canelo,
right.
Golovkin? All that's going to happen after that fight does shitty numbers
it's
because
getting
of
gobbled
this.
Up.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And where does that leave us, with 2017? This will be the defining
yeah.
fight of one of the best years in a long time. And what promoters are going to – sorry, go ahead.
I was just thinking, I sure hope not, if you mean by Mayweather-McGregor.
I do. I do mean that.
Oh,
and I think what marketing people are going to look at is how dominant this was over a real fight of substance like Golovkin-Canelo, which I mean
yeah.
– I wonder what the economic impact is going to be on that fight. I think it's going to be enormous. I totally think it's going to get drowned by this. So then where does that place boxing, not just 2018, but 10 years from now? They're going to come up with more freak shows like this, I think.
I mean, I sure hope not, but I just don't. I don't trust the people in boxing, especially if you go over my Twitter feed and you see what I tweeted yesterday. But I don't trust the people in boxing enough to do the right thing, or to do the honorable thing, or to do the thing that is best for the sport. Or, you know, I don't trust them enough to do that kind of thing, to believe that this won't have a long-term impact. I really wish it wouldn't, but I'm not an idiot also. But I think that it's kind of a worst-case scenario here. A worst-case scenario for Mayweather-McGregor and its outcome and what happens and things like that. Literally, a worst-case scenario would be if they somehow just totally threw out all ethics and morality entirely and were like, fuck it, let's have Floyd fight shitty, or something like that, or some arrangement, or even if it weren't an arrangement and it actually legitimately happened that McGregor beat Mayweather like by knockout and we wind up running this down again. That would literally, I think, be a very, like, worst-case scenario type of thing all around. And holy shit, I might, like, jump off some bridge somewhere if that happened. And there are a lot of bridges in Portland, Bren. A lot of bridges.
I've passed through your town, and you're absolutely, they're very nice bridges also. But no, it's crazy. It's really, I kind of assumed that Pacquiao Mayweather would leave me so jaded. And I mean, I think I wrote the most jaded account of the fucking thing, like 22,000 words on deadline that I filed on a Monday after a Saturday night fight. And I came away from it with Mickey Duguay, who illustrated the fucking thing. We were so miserable by this entire fiasco of an event. And you know, like this, I remember like in Vegas, because we were there really sober trying to report enough that we could get like 20,000 words and 30 illustrations or whatever, that the moment we had like one evening where we had a few drinks, we were like, place isn't so bad. This is okay. And it was the same thing with the Mayweather-McGregor. I should have been wasted, like just drowned in alcohol to be able to palliate the thing, then maybe it would make sense. But if you're not, like, that's what I'm wondering is, like, what are people getting juiced on by this? Like, this is 1,000 to 1. So it clearly has nothing to do with the competitiveness of the fight. And even scouring like YouTube, and you're seeing like celebrities who are being pulled. Marky Mark is like, well, you know, McGregor can punch and he's not going to be afraid to take a few shots from Mayweather. I'm like, you've been around boxing for years. How can you possibly think that somebody like McGregor is going to be able to, I mean, I think Mayweather could win this thing in 2 minutes, like regardless of him having shitty hands and he can't punch. I think Kellerman is absolutely right. I think if Mayweather wanted to, he could probably go half the fight and never get touched by anything that McGregor would throw at him. That's my sense of it. Maybe I'm way off, but everything that I've ever seen in boxing gyms tells me, you know, this could be any sport. This could be somebody walking into chess playing a world champion where the levels are so, like, precipitous of ability, and Floyd at the top of that level, and McGregor is nowhere. Like McGregor probably wouldn't be competitive in a boxing match with somebody who's like ranked 50th in the world. I still think he'd be routed if he fought somebody in his weight class who is like the 50th best boxer in that weight, and he's going to walk in with Floyd Mayweather. Whew.
I don't want to place too much emphasis or, you know, too much importance in sparring, but we've already seen what Conor McGregor is unable to do against a fairly kind of middling boxer in Chris Van Heerden. It's kind of fringe contendery, you know. He's not a particularly skilled boxer that I've seen, you know, in his professional fights. They're on YouTube. You can go look. And we've already seen that he could barely touch the guy. And on top of barely being able to touch the guy, like, if you just – I'll try to keep this short so we can move on in a moment. But if you
right.
just – I'm kind of wary of, like, you know, staying on this too long.
I know.
But if you just kind of even watch these little clips of McGregor sparring or doing his little fucking katas and stuff like that, he does these funky movements where, like, he poses when he punches, thinking as if that's kind of some rhythm-breaking anomaly that's going to be mystical or magical or confuse the shit out of an opponent. But if you can actually see it in real time in this sparring session against Chris Van Eerden, where he's like, he throws a right hand, but then leaves his right hand there, right where he threw it, and then kind of waits for the guy to try to counter it, and then tries to counter that. But the way that he does it leaves him so out of position that he gets, like, you know, smacked with the right hand and, you know, get turned sideways, almost as if he doesn't understand the mechanics and balance of boxing versus MMA. And it's like, that's exactly what we're going to see play out against Floyd Mayweather, because he does the exact same things if you watch his workouts and shit now. There's no change. He hasn't learned anything. His boxing basically consists of funky footwork and, you know, unorthodox hand movements that don't really work that well in a boxing ring unless you are some special case like a Pernell Whitaker or Emmanuel Augustus or something like that, somebody who has a really strange rhythm that makes it work. That's
right.
The anomaly. That shit is not often. You don't see it very often. So anyway, I just can't imagine a scenario where, barring some really freak, unfortunate, nightmarish accident, Conor McGregor can stay competitive in this, much less win.
No. I mean, Anderson Silva, probably, I mean, all the people I know in boxing who've seen him were like, he might be able to move over into boxing. That guy's so otherworldly in what he does in the UFC. And his professional boxing career is 1-1, knocked out once. And I think Anderson Silva is 100 times a better candidate to fight in boxing than McGregor. It just the optics, you know, my immediate takeaway watching the guy move. And I watched, like, several highlight reels of McGregor's stuff. I mean, it's very impressive inside an octagon, but no, it doesn't translate at all in terms of what he could do as a boxer. And you're absolutely right. The way he poses after throwing punches, that's only going to work against somebody that has never been involved in the sport of boxing, because that is a very basic pedestrian way to just leave yourself available to get fucking destroyed. And nobody is better equipped, arguably, in the history of the sport to take advantage of that than Floyd Mayweather Jr.
Yeah, exactly. It's like a kind of a just really polar opposites against each other stylistically. And I think that that's really what's going to be played out and amplified in the ring. So leaving this shit behind here, because there will be plenty of opportunities to talk about the depravity of it and how, you know, just depressed we are from this. This past weekend, at least on HBO, we had a pretty decent little triple header. It didn't deliver quite like I had hoped. You know, I damn near guaranteed scintillating action, and my guarantee fell through. But still, it was solid, and I think that it was, at the very least, a really good escape for a lot of people from this Mayweather-McGregor discussion and whatnot. We needed a boxing weekend that was just kind of loaded, even if it wasn't loaded with really great shit. So on HBO, the main event was Miguel Burchelt versus Takashi Miura, 130-pound fight that was for Burchelt's WBC belt. The belt's kind of irrelevant in a way, as it, I mean, these kind of belts and the alphabet belts and whatnot are becoming more and more irrelevant as time goes by, it seems, because are just increasingly aware of who the guy or who the handful of guys to fight are in a given division. 130 pounds is no exception. So the big name and the big matchup, at least as far as coming away from this fight, this main event on HBO, is, of course, Lomachenko. Vasily Lomachenko, he's clearly the premier talent right around the 130-pound mark. I think that, unfortunately, despite all of the drama and whatnot with Guillermo Rigondo, he's just kind of left on the wayside, and I don't really think that that's going to be changing anytime soon, especially given the weight class stuff. Where do you think Miguel Burchelt figures into all this? Because he's taken out Francisco Vargas. He's taken out the guy that Vargas took out in Miura. He's kind of just stamping out as many of these other contenders as he can in the division. So how far do you think he can get?
I was really impressed with his unanimous decision. I thought he fought really well, and I agree. I mean, I think what could happen with Lomachenko is very similar with Guillermo in terms of, like, who the hell wants a piece of that? You're going to look terrible. You're probably going to get knocked out. And to look that outclassed, as both of those guys are really capable to do, and especially since Lomachenko is so much younger, it's a shame. I mean, he's just one of those ones that's so profoundly gifted in the ring to watch, and even more so live. I mean, he's just one of those guys, like great dancers, where you really watch him do things and second guess that you actually saw him do it. Like, you look around, like, did he just do that to people who are around you? So I hope he gets a lot more opportunities to be active. I know HBO is very big on him. I totally agree with you that they're never going to let Rigondeaux fight him. They have no interest in dealing with Rigondeaux, his people, his complete lack of ratings. So I hold absolutely no hope for that, which is very disappointing. I think it would be a great fight to watch, even though Rigondeaux, I think he just turned 97 last September. So, I mean, he could use a gift before he hits 100. But no, I thought Burchelt was really impressive, and I think he wants to have big challenges, and he looks good with these fights, fighting, you know, steamrolling elite level competition. So he's a blue chip for sure.
Yeah, he's clearly it's tough to really put anybody in Lomachenko's class at this point. Whether pound for pound or at 130 pounds. Clearly, I mean, there's a ways to go for the whole pound for pound discussion, and that's always an open discussion. But still, I think that he's proven himself to be just kind of a cut above a number of these guys. And it's not as if Miguel Burchelt didn't get touched by Takashi Miura, who is not a particularly skilled guy in the classical sense. He's not a particularly quick guy, easy to hit himself. But, I mean, he just doesn't stop. That's the whole thing with Takashi Miura, and God love the guy for it. He's just a machine in that regard. But I don't know that I would take this performance and say, put him right in with Lomachenko, and I think that you got to figure he'll be competitive or he'll do this or that. I still think Lomachenko is just kind of a little bit out of that league. Still, this is why we have the fights, though, because we still have to figure out if that's the case. But 130 pounds is a fun division, and it kind of has been for a few years, and this just is another example of the division being very competitive.
Yeah, I totally agree, and one of the things I really like and admire about Lomachenko is I think he has a real willingness to move in weight classes for big fights. I think he's just so confident. I mean, he kind of reminds me of like, you know, certain running backs in the NFL in their prime that just stood out, like you know, like a Barry Sanders, for example. Even people at that top level look at them and just marvel at what they're doing, and yet you see that they're that caliber of athlete very often is somebody always looking for challenges, bigger challenges. So I could see him, you know, I wonder if he would be interested in, like, the winner of Garcia Broner. Either one, I think, would be amazing to watch Lomachenko fight. And probably a pretty decent payday to watch something like that. You know, that could be interesting. But I agree with you. I don't think anybody's in Lomachenko's class right now. I don't know who would even look competitive. He looks like he's playing with elite level competition, and there's, you know, if the pound for pound discussion is really about that, like the distance between them and the next guy, Lomachenko's number one. You know, whatever debates we have about Andre Ward with Kovalev, where they're both elite pound for pound guys, Ward is not walking through Kovalev. Ward has trouble with Kovalev. He is struggling to find a way to win, which he did. But he doesn't look like he's in another league from Kovalev. They're very, very competitive. Whereas Lomachenko, we haven't seen anybody look remotely competitive against him, and it's hard to imagine anybody would. But that being said, like, let's put him in with some more people. You'd think with his amateur pedigree that he's seen every possible style that's available, but I'd love to see him. Let's start him fighting every month or two. You know, he's young, he's in his prime, he never seems to get hurt in any of these fights. Let's get on with it. Let's showcase the guy. Let's create a fighter who gets a legacy, not necessarily built on pay-per-view numbers, but just on how good they look. I mean, what a concept.
Man, that seems so alien.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, this 130-pound division, it's a pretty damn good division in general. And another guy in the division who was on this HBO Boxing After Dark card was Jezreel Corrales, and he wound up kind of just edging Robinson Castellanos. And this just kind of adds to the division. I mean, it was a bit of a truncated fight. It ended really in the 10th round because there was just a lot of shoving and collisions and just, it wasn't necessarily really dirty. It was just a bad style clash, a lot of holding, a lot of just tangling and, you know, that kind of stuff. And sometimes you get those styles where that happens. And I saw a lot of calls for a rematch. I really want to see a rematch of that per se. I think that overall the right guy in Corrales got away with a close win, but if I'm anybody on his team, I say let's move on and try to push ourselves toward the rest of the 130-pound mix.
Yeah, totally agree. And it is a rich division. It's a nice weight class, a nice mix of power and speed and ability. Like it showcases boxing at its best, I think. I think a lot of us, when we first come to the sport, we like the big guys, but after a while, when you begin to appreciate just the technique, the big guys seldomly bring much of it, but these guys cannot exist without being in peak condition and having, you know, a lifelong dedication to their craft, and then even then bringing just so many God-given gifts that are just sharpened over just decades. So, you know, Lomachenko is the mountaintop of that, but still, it's just a fun division to watch. I've really enjoyed, I mean, Rigondeaux was the one who really was my gateway drug into the lower weight classes, appreciating what these guys are able to do, but it's astonishing, like their technical mastery. So I hope more people can kind of get into the lower weight classes and enjoy what they do, but it's a little bit more of an acquired taste. It takes a little bit more, I don't like the word refinement, but you know what I mean, like to kind of get into it because, and actually paradoxically, there's more danger in the lower weight classes in terms of what's knocking them down is very often the accumulation of blows rather than the big shots, and that is probably doing more trauma to their brains than the bigger guys who are going to fall after concussive shots. So you could argue that they're taking more risks in the lower weight classes as well. So so it's a good time for that division for sure.
It's tough to really get the momentum for these divisions going when you have mainstream stars like BJ Flores maligning the lower weight classes. I mean, he's so mainstream, you know, he's so just like really popular and pay-per-view star. So it makes it tough. Just kidding. Guy's kind of an asshole. People, I really do hope that people are kind of getting on this bandwagon a little bit for the lower weight classes in the last few years. There's been more showcasing of these lower weight classes, lower being, I guess, probably below about welterweight, really. That's kind of sad to think about, but that is the case, that, you know, below maybe welterweight or perhaps lightweight, it's just not much of a push to get a lot of these guys out there. But 130 pounds is a good division, and hopefully these guys, you know, still find themselves getting showcased in the future on HBO. But I think that with recent shakeups and mix-ups, especially with top rank more or less moving to ESPN, hopefully we'll find more creativity with HBO's boxing programming, assuming it continues. But the other fight on that card was a light heavyweight fight. Now, Joe Smith Jr., the big story coming into this fight was Joe Smith Jr., who took on Sullivan Barrera and lost. The big story coming into this fight, of course, was that Joe Smith Jr. is kind of an everyman. He's a construction worker, a union guy, a guy who still has a full-time job despite being a world-ranked light heavyweight who, coming off of wins over Andrew Funfara and Bernard Hopkins last year, but again, like I said last week, didn't really seem to get much of a promotional push, didn't really seem to capitalize off of those wins. Whoever's responsible for that, whether it's a manager, promoter, a handler, HBO, I have no idea, but kind of ripened on the vine a little bit from those wins. And we also learned that in his loss to Barrera this past weekend, he had his jaw broken really early in the fight and now has to have surgery. Usually not a very good career sign. Sometimes those things get rebroken. Anyway, the larger picture is that unfortunately we were denied a bit of a Cinderella story against Barrera, even though we got kind of two against Funfara and Hopkins. But Sullivan Barrera moves forward. It's a little bit of a frustrating outcome, in my opinion, because we've seen some issues with Barrera in the last few months in putting fights together. Even though this was, on paper, a high-quality fight, I'm just not really sure where to go with this, where the light heavyweight division goes. What is Andre Ward going to do as a light heavyweight? Is he going to fight again at all? Does anybody care? I don't know. Donna Stevenson? Anyway, the light heavyweight division is just kind of in a funky spot. And even though this was a pretty solid win for Barrera, I don't really know what it translates to. I have no idea.
No, it was an interesting fight. We talked about him last week, Joe Smith Jr. He's a fun guy to root for. He broke his jaw and fought a further 9 rounds with a broken jaw, which doesn't sound like a lot of fun. And as you know, this is one of the things with boxing, you know, he was already thinking about retirement. I read some quotes after the fight where he referenced that fractured jaw, and and he was gracious in defeat. I think he's got a lot of heart, but he did already reference the fact that he's thinking about, should I go on? Like, was this enough? And maybe he's humble enough to recognize his limitations at the elite level. He definitely caught Hopkins at the right time, Hopkins being 75 years old when they fought. But, if he's having
Joe
these
Smith
kind
Jr.,
of problems.
That's day one. That's day one, right. Joe Smith Jr.
Right. So, you know, maybe he is going to walk away. It's definitely a big sign if somebody's thinking retirement after their first kind of loss or real bout with adversity. Maybe, I'm not saying that boxing was a dalliance for him by any stretch, but I mean, as you say, he's kept a full-time job on the side while he's boxing, which is another interesting commentary on the sport, that if you're not rich, you do need a second job in order to make ends meet. If you have a family or even just to support yourself, it's a real grind. How many people, we forget every paycheck that these guys are getting. When we hear the big numbers, we forget that there's no sport where their check hemorrhages money like boxing, paying a third of their earnings to a trainer, 10% to a strength and conditioning coach, paying for their own camp and on and on and on, with no medical insurance, with no retirement plan. You know, none of them are a member of any union to look after their interests. I mean, it is scary out there. If you're pro-capitalism, there is no, you know, bigger expression of it than what boxers are confronted with economically. So maybe, yeah, it's just interesting to see a young guy where we were saying, like, where can he go? And already, just after one fight that by no means was a tune-up for bigger things, but it was a real stepping stone, and now it's already maybe that's the last we'll see of him. And I agree with you. The light heavyweight division is in a strange spot. I don't know where Ward goes to, you know, made $6.5 million to fight a rematch that lost a fifth of the viewership that the original fight with Kovalev had. So I think he is looking, you know, probably to fight Tony Bellew in the UK, where they can sell out anywhere for that kind of fight, being, you know, England being what it is as far as, you know, a country that is just boxing crazy and trying to create really good, interesting fights. I think that would be a very competitive fight. I think I would favor Ward. I mean, what do you think if those two squared off over there?
If which two? Ward and who? Barrera?
Ward and Tony Bellew.
Oh, okay. Sorry, I missed the Bellew part. I mean, I just don't know. Like, we kind of talked about this after the Ward-Kovalev rematch, but, I mean, I just don't know. It's a huge challenge for Ward. And so in that sense, if Ward actually, you know, kind of started trying to actually transcend weight classes here and move up and took on legit challenges and not just kind of, you know, fringe guys or, you know, pick and choose type of stuff, I think that would be fairly impressive, because he's not a very big light heavyweight. And in spots, he was getting pushed around by Sergey Kovalev. But I just don't know. I don't really see Tony Bellew as a particularly effective heavyweight yet. So I'm not really sure if that's like the best barometer, but Ward is just so not big as a light heavyweight. I have a tough time seeing him competing, you know, much over that weight.
No, I mean, Ward, I wouldn't say Ward looks small as a light heavyweight. I mean, he's stepping on the scales at 175, but he's not
tiny.
A big guy. He's not tiny, but he's, you know, he's not a big man, and, you know, which is probably, he deserves credit that he's probably one of the least suspected of using PEDs just based on his physique. He looks the way old-time fighters look. You know, he doesn't look jacked. He looks like a guy who's given his whole life to the sport, and he's in shape, but he doesn't have that superhuman look that, you know, Ken Norton was certainly the outlier in the 1970s with that kind of physique, and now it's the standard. Ward doesn't have that look. So it's another reason, I think, to respect him. And I don't know the intimate details, so I'm just saying just the optics of it. But it definitely makes you think, if this guy is going to beef up to 200 pounds, he's going to lose something in terms of the way he's able to fight now. I don't see him becoming like a, you know, suddenly emerging as a massive puncher at 200 pounds. And he's probably going to lose something on speed and his reflexes and his timing. And, you know, as he's getting older, gaining some weight, you know, your joints don't care if it's muscle or it's fat. They just care about that impact, the wear and tear of training. And I've never heard any athlete that I've ever interviewed or spent time with complain, mainly off the record, about that they're constantly in pain due to injuries they've sustained throughout their career. He made it really, really clear that he is somebody suffering physically on a day-to-day basis and expects to for the rest of his life as a result of what he gave up to pursue boxing full-time. He's that dedicated. So, I just assume that he wants to go up there for some big payday and maybe the UK and having a huge audience that would probably appreciate him a lot more than his native United States and our boxing contingent would appeal to him. Probably a big payday over there as well. So I think he just kind of wants to cash in, unless something dramatically different happens than he expects to happen against fighting Tony Bellew. You know, what happens if he loses? Where does his career go? It could suddenly get very, very interesting. But as of now, I'm sure he just is probably thinking two fights, try to make as much money as he can before he goes on to the next phase of his career. And maybe it will work out that way, or maybe life will get in the way and we'll see a very interesting chapter in that guy's career.
Yeah, and these other kind of light heavyweights add potential flair to that plan, I suppose. But I guess it just depends on which way he wants to go. I don't know. And I, like I said before, not really a massive Andre Ward fan, never really have been. But despite that, the sport of boxing, in my opinion, is better if he fights more often.
Yeah. Absolutely agree. I do think there'll be a reappraisal of him at some point. I just think about 9 people are going to care about the reappraisal. He just didn't connect. He just didn't connect. It happens. It happens in all sports. There are guys that just go beneath the radar, and he gives all evidence, seeing that, you know, he's accomplished as much as he has, you know, era-defining accomplishments. No question. With, you know, Floyd Mayweather wasn't able to get the gold medal in the Olympics. And I think it was a lot harder for Ward to do what he did than it was for Floyd, because of their respective styles. And I think probably Floyd had more natural ability, definitely started earlier than Ward, which is a scary thought when you think somebody like Andre Ward starts boxing full time, very seriously at 12. Floyd was doing it when he was 3. You know, 3-5 years old, you know, living in a gym. You know, he had 7 years of being around it before Ward ever did. But Ward has done as much as he possibly could with the talent he was given as anybody probably in the history of boxing. He's been that consistent, that dedicated. So I give him full props for that. But nobody gave a flying fuck about it. So we have to, I think, address that as well. And I don't question people not, that's where commerce, there is some justice to it. If you don't move to sort of meet where the audience is, you can forever say it's their problem for not appreciating you. But in the end, like, I don't even think people have to move on from Andre Ward. They were never there to begin with.
And may never get there. I mean, if the pay-per-view numbers are any indicator, I don't know that they ever will. And it's sad, too, because both of the Kovalev fights were very competitive, you know, at least on paper, competitive high-level fights. So I don't know that that will ever change. But the other thing that I kind of wanted to slide in there, and I know we were going to make the show somewhat short today, but or at least shorter. I don't know that an hour is short for many people, but shorter than usual. Another thing that I kind of wanted to just wedge in there, if we could, was I'm not sure if you caught it. I'm sure you at least caught the result of Chris Eubank Jr. defeating Arthur Abraham. Yes,
right.
That former middleweight titleist, Arthur Abraham, the guy who kind of just puts his gloves up and covers up a lot of the time or follows an opponent around if he can't get a knockout. That guy is pretty much what happened. The big story here, I mean, Chris Eubank Jr. is kind of on the rise. Arthur Abraham is very clearly not on the rise. He's very clearly on the darker side of his career here. The bigger story, though, is that with this win over Arthur Abraham, it's not a meaningless win, but the win over Arthur Abraham puts Eubank Jr. into the World Boxing Super Series. Now, I brought this up before on last week's show, but in case anybody is unsure what this is, the World Boxing Super Series is a tournament style series that is being done, you know, in Europe, basically. Well, not basically, it is being held in Europe, and there's a super middleweight bracket and there's a cruiserweight bracket, and Eubank Jr. is moving into this. A lot of the guys in the super middleweight bracket are kind of European-based fighters, so many of them are guys that American fight fans might not be super familiar with. But rest assured, it's high-level stuff, and that these fighters are—they're legit. They're not per—they're not maybe not like ultimate world-class, you know, high-ranked guys, but they many of them are undefeated. Many of them are very skilled or have already proven that they belong or deserve to be, you know, high level kind of fringe contender guys or almost contender guys. The cruiserweight bracket, though, is, I think, far more interesting for a lot of people. And so anyway, Eubanks' win puts him into this tournament, the super middleweight one. And that's, in my opinion, fairly big news and adds to more bigger news in the what's already been a pretty good 2017. As I started out the show saying, 2017's been good, and it's easy to get stuck on the Mayweather-McGregor stuff, because we did, but it also, I think, we need periodic reminders, and I almost need to remind myself, because it's easy for me to get cynical and negative, so I need to keep reminding myself, hey, dude, 2017's been pretty good. Like, don't complain too much. This has been a damn good year. So these tournaments, I think, add to that.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And I mean, look for all the talk of boxing dying. The UK has promoters putting up $50 million for an 8-man competition, which is going to start in September and October. And as you say, it's not against big man competition, but this is going to give them an opportunity to be showcased in the UK in front of big audiences. They're probably going to sell out wherever they're fighting. And UK TV audiences are big. It's a lot more affordable. It's a lot more inclusive. This is really, really good for the development of the sport over there to keep it vibrant, to get new faces in front of people's eyes so that they can get acquainted with their stories, their fighting styles and all that in very competitive matches. A lot of these are pick'em fights. You're seeing, you know, some undefeated fighters, some people like Eubank who just lost one fight but fought their way to get into it. There's big money to be earned. That's the kind of thing that is going to plant seeds in that audience if there are kids watching who are going to think, instead of going to play soccer or some other sport, why don't I go to a boxing gym so I can be like that guy who, you know, maybe looks like me, maybe fights the way I would like to fight. I mean, that's one of the great things about the sport that is not true of any others is whoever you are, whatever, you know, size you are, tall or big or small or whatever, there's a guy out there who looks like you, who's fighting as a professional. So that kind of identification is so much easier with boxing than it is with any other sport. It just seems like the UK gets that, and there is a slew of promoters that are really trying to think longer term than Americans. And you know, you're seeing it, the most obvious cynical example is this McGregor, you know, Mayweather thing. But the UK is always just trying to put together good fights, good shows, get it in front of a lot of people so they make it affordable. And I just think it just helps everybody in the sport. And, I mean, isn't it interesting that Ward is immediately thinking, I need to get over to the UK? He didn't mention Billu. I heard that sort of in the grapevine of boxing writers and people in management. But you know, and I think a lot more people are going to see going to the UK as a much more viable option to make money, and just it's going to be more—it's just a more enjoyable atmosphere to fight in the future. And that maybe American promoters can sort of move to follow that model of instead of looking for the Super Bowls, trying to put on playoff caliber fights and create more tournaments like this where you're going to see. You know, just the best that the sport can offer as far as the talent being utilized on a regular basis so it's in front of people a lot more often. So we don't see a fighter and then they don't come back for 10 months or whatever, which has happened far too often with a lot of the most talented guys in the sport.
I think really the key word that you brought up is investment. In the U.S.
Right.
especially and on TV and you know, this has really been a big part of the difficulty here. And this is also why Premier Boxing Champions was such a big deal when it was announced and when the figures were released. And then now why it's such a big deal that it's kind of on paper. Like, I mean, it's it's very difficult to see that. It's very difficult to see the forest for the trees, because the trees are the fights, and you see the fights happening. You see them on various networks, and often they're very good. It's tough to see what's going on behind the scenes. And my whole point in bringing this up is, when we heard that there was hundreds of millions of dollars being invested into this promotional company that had a huge stable of fighters, we're like, holy shit, this could get interesting. Needless to say, it's played out a lot differently than many of us had hoped. It's played out how many of us thought it would have played out in some regards. But regardless, this whole World Boxing Super Series thing, again, is just more proof that I think, these tournaments do not have the kind of names that a Premier Boxing Champions stable had when it was announced. So obviously you kind of have to take that into consideration, and you're like, if anybody's sitting there thinking, oh, 50 million, well, Premier Boxing Champions got hundreds of millions. Well, again, the names aren't there, but this is a tournament of fighters, none of which are massive stars. But obviously there are investors who believe enough in this tournament and the potential of boxing in influencing and obviously bringing money back to invest $50 million into this tournament, when otherwise it would be really difficult to get that kind of figure to invest in boxing currently, and in the U.S. is almost impossible. So I think that that's really fantastic, especially for European boxing and for UK boxing. I wish we had more things like that here in the U.S. Showtime tried to do it a few times in the 2000s and in the early 2010s, and to kind of varying degrees of success. But I think ultimately figured it was way more trouble than it was worth, and other promoters have done similar things. But I think this is just an all-around investment from the promoters, from the fighters, from the actual investors, that's a good sign for boxing long-term, hopefully, if not in the U.S.
Yeah, it needs it. It needs to be revamped where there's just organization, so it's not just this big, weird black box on all fronts of the most powerful guy in boxing doesn't talk to anybody, and he finds his way into power, and then once he gets all this money, what's accomplished with the money? Nothing discernible that's good for the sport is accomplished, other than his fighters were grossly overpaid, but in terms of the welfare of the sport, where it was primarily being marketed to in the U.S., are we any better for $500 million dropped into putting it on TV? Not in any appreciable way that I can see. So with the UK, it just seems like these are not brilliant maneuvers that's just making it work. Make it affordable. Keep it on TV. Make the shows fun to watch. Good matchups. Have promoters put on good undercards. Like, make there be a reason to not just show up for the main event. Make events be something that people talk about. Look at the way the Joshua Klitschko fight resounded, where both Joshua and Klitschko are not names in the U.S. that Americans care about, let alone that they want to pay for. And in the U.K., it makes for one of the most memorable fights in the last 100 years that they've put on, and just sends shockwaves through the sport that you've got an athlete with well over a dozen sponsors that want to support him because of what he represents. Imagine if he's able to do something similar in the U.S. I think it was very interesting to hear Joshua say his intention was to become the sport's first billionaire, and how is he going about doing it? He is, unlike Mayweather, where he claims to be the face of the sport or boxing's on my back, he's hurting the sport. He's injuring the sport. He's damaging the ecosystem. He's making it harder for people to come up and try to rise to the top as a result of what his legacy is meaning. It will be a real blessing when that guy finally does retire and walks away, and we can scrub clean the damage he's done to the sport because of his legacy. Not the first half, but certainly since he became the Money Mayweather character, I think it's done tremendous damage. Joshua is the counterbalance to that. Joshua and I think what he represents with the way the UK is structuring their promotions, I just think it's very, very positive and puts the best face forward with boxing, where a lot of people are benefiting with every one of these really good shows that they're putting on. And I'm hoping that American promoters can take their cues from just how effective it is, rather than just very, very few people profiting, and they show the box office and say, look at what a success it is, but clearly in any other metric, it's a fucking colossal failure that makes everybody's job a lot harder.
Right.
The UK seems to have a real apparatus, from gyms being affordable for kids who can't pay fees to get in to work out and find a trainer who wants to support them, and by the way, a mentor or a surrogate father figure to help steer them clear of crime or any of the pitfalls of the community they're coming from, which is what we used to have here. So you just see a lot of the things that worked here with boxing helping a lot of people, that's all gone. And in the UK, that sort of boxing as vessel to the American dream is thriving more than it ever has. They've got more champions than they've ever had. So I don't know why the hell we're not learning from it and trying to implement some of the things they're doing, because they could easily be done.
It sure sometimes feels like it's almost a borderline nihilistic, or like a scorched earth type of thing, where basically they're saying, we're just going to extract everything we can out of this situation, and if nobody can later on, fuck it. Oh, well. And that's kind of how, you know, I'm not going to say that that is the attitude of promoters, and I don't know what they're thinking. All I know is that many of them are making a lot of money off of these fights, and sometimes it's for not doing that much at all. And that, you know, they're not leaving much. It's kind of like, like, not to get fucking bleeding heart here, but it's basically what's happening with the planet and corporations. Nobody's really leaving much for future generations here. Same for boxing. And that's concerning. Hopefully there are enough good people, enough people who are capable of having kind of more long-term thinking, and people who are taking the sport's best interest at heart to turn things around. Is that really going to be the case? You know, it's doubtful, as it always is, but hopefully. We'll see.
I think what enough people have to recognize, until it creates enough momentum, is that there is an existential threat. And what Mayweather's doing is taking boxing away from the sport in terms of the way it's marketed. And that is a threat. But if it becomes this freak show where actual competitive boxing becomes meaningless in terms of, you know, trying to appeal to a broader audience, rather than put on more competitive fights or whatever. I mean, look what happened in Hollywood, where you have blockbusters are all that sells, and the blockbusters don't have to be good. They just need a good trailer. That's Mayweather McGregor. You just need a good trailer that gets them in, and then there's not enough time for them to tell their friends how fucking shitty the movie is. And that's their business model, is ripping people off. And you see, when the technology allows us to fuck over the people who've been fucking us over, what do you know? There's no consumer loyalty, because they didn't give a shit about us. You know, they didn't.
Right.
When it's more affordable to put on, do they make it cheaper? Fuck no, because there's more profit to be made, and you're an idiot if you don't just cash in at every short-term opportunity. So I think that's what would have to happen with boxing, is that there are, as you're seeing in the UK, they're thriving. The U.S. is really struggling in a lot of ways, and you're going to see a big moment is if, let's say, Golovkin and Canelo dramatically underperforms from what the expectations are as a result of Mayweather, maybe you're going to see some major pushback from people at HBO, from organizers, promoters, and that kind of thing, saying, look, like, this was not easy to put together. This should have been a fucking slam dunk Super Bowl of a fight, and now it's relegated to sort of what Andrei Ward Kovalev was. That could create problems, because boxing's ecosystem has depended on these major fights happening every year or two, And if one gets completely sabotaged by this bullshit fucking Mayweather-McGregor parade, it could make people rethink that calculus, I hope.
I hope so, and that was kind of the hope after Mayweather-Pacquiao, too, that rather than people getting ideas, that it would kind of deter some of this stuff, but we're already seeing that it didn't. So, this is me tugging my collar. Sorry.
Well, no, you're absolutely right to say it's just the mentality of script mining. What script mining is to nature, this is to boxing's ecosystem. And those are people that need to be fucking driven out, because there needs to be some other metric of success beyond the cash register, because that is short term. We lost a lot more fans because of the quote unquote success of Pacquiao Mayweather. And we saw that when he tried to have competitive boxing matches, and they weren't even competitive, but I just mean the remainder on his contract to fulfill it. Nobody gave a fuck. The face of boxing, and look at his pay-per-view numbers after Pacquiao. He's not carrying boxing on his back. You know, it didn't at all. Canelo is getting better numbers than Mayweather after losing to Mayweather. So that's just bullshit. And he has to resort to a freak show in order to sell tickets. But I don't think that if Mayweather fought Golovkin, it would have broken or even maybe done even half the numbers of Pacquiao Mayweather. So that's instructive, you know, to keep in mind as well, I think, is that Mayweather recognizes that he did do damage, and I think that's why he had to resort to something like this on top of this massive tax debt he apparently owes, which is sort of interesting.
Yeah, interesting, and also, you know, not a new thing, you know, not only fighters, you know, the IRS has been going after many people who don't pay their taxes on a large scale for many, many years. So it's not exactly as Floyd Mayweather's painting it, that he's like a victim or something. But, you know, he's just bad at paying his taxes, which he's not the first rich person to be bad at paying his taxes. But that's probably at least a motivating factor behind this fight, needless to say. But I just, you know, hopefully this does not wind up being the norm is all I can say. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. We're in a really interesting time on so many different levels, and I can't say I feel terribly optimistic, but it's it's interesting times.
Let me ask you before we get going. It sounded like yesterday. I don't know if it what stage of finalization it's gone to, so I don't really know. But it sounded like yesterday there was some kind of fuel behind the rumors that Deontay Wilder versus Luis Ortiz was going to be made for some time in the next few months. What do you think of that fight? And what do you think of this heavyweight division we got here?
Love that fight. Really like Ortiz. King Kong I wish he wasn't 64 years old. But he's big, he's strong, he's very skilled, and is a southpaw. Deontay Wilder, great puncher. I think his personality is compelling. I don't think he would last very long against Joshua. I don't see him in that class. He still looks to me like a basketball player boxing. He doesn't quite look like a boxer to me yet. He still looks like a very athletic basketball player who spent a couple years boxing. Like, I don't know. Do you have that feeling when you watch him?
Yeah, I do, because I think that, there's been various little memes and edits done of his flailing. I don't know if you saw the one that was, you know, somebody set, what fight was it? It might have been like the Spielka fight or something like that. But there was at some point at one of his recent fights where he was just flailing like a madman, like it was flailing all over the place. And so someone had taken a little clip of that and set it to music for like a minute or two, and it was outstanding. But he's very sloppy. He has been ever since he was an amateur. I remember seeing clips of him, and the big sell, of course, was that he was 6'6", 6'7", however tall he is, and that, you know, this was potentially the next great American heavyweight way back then. And I remember seeing clips of him and thinking, yeah, oh, Jesus, he is raw as hell. You know, he's just not super skilled. We need to really work on that. Some things he has worked on, he has a very good jab. He is able to use his reach well, but when he starts getting hit, when it's kind of heat of the moment type of stuff, he does not react as if a fighter who has been fighting since they were 6, 7, 9, 10 years old reacts. He starts flailing. He starts getting wild. He starts kind of, you know, punching from his heels type of shit. And that's also gotten him into trouble. It just hasn't gotten him a loss yet. Eventually it will. I just can't imagine it won't. Luis Ortiz might be the guy that it comes against, because Luis Ortiz is a guy who has a shitload of experience. He is older, of course, and that poses a real X factor, but he has a lot of experience. He knows what to do in a lot of different situations in the ring, and so it might literally just come down to, can Luis Ortiz take Deontay Wilder's power? And if he can, then that might be game over, Wilder.
Yeah, no, I mean, I cheer for Wilder. I agree with everything you said. I think he looks sloppy, but he's fun. And you saw that troll who went into his boxing gym and Wilder like chased him down and beat the shit out of him, I think, sparring. It was fun. And I don't know, he showed just enough restraint that it wasn't kind of off-putting. It seemed like a very just comeuppance that I kind of changed my perception of Wilder after that incident, because somebody was mocking him and he stepped up to the plate with it. And I think he at least aspires to have all the big fights. I don't think he wants to duck anybody. I think he believes rightly that if he can connect with anybody with a clean shot, he's going to knock them out. That's always going to be interesting with a guy at his size. But I think, like we saw, it kind of reminds me of Michael Grant from, 15 years ago, who looked, you know, just like a crazy specimen, just physically. And then, you know, he fights a real boxer like Lennox Lewis and crumples almost immediately. So, you know, we've gone over many, many times how underappreciated Lennox Lewis really is, because he is that superhuman specimen physically, who also was just a superb boxer in terms of skills and just his intelligence of how he applied his skills. But I don't see that guy. I still think Lewis in his prime would have destroyed Joshua, either Klitschko brother and certainly, you know, anybody who's out there in the heavyweight landscape right now. What I like is that the heavyweight landscape, everybody is a little bit at risk at the elite level if they square up. No matter who the matchup is, there are risks. And that is very interesting when you have guys willingly wanting to step into those challenges and to assert their claim as being the best guy. So I think Joshua, I hope they don't put the brakes on and he fights once a year, but heavyweight division certainly could use a tournament to get these guys fighting very often. And I love the idea of Ortiz stepping up into the elite level. And Wilder, you know, Wilder seems like he wants to fight anybody. He's fun to watch. Definitely you could get an interesting rivalry with, you know, his fan base being an American fighting over in the UK, or vice versa, bringing a UK over. I think it would make more sense to have it in the UK, just with, you know, what we saw with Joshua and Klitschko and the amount of people that filled that stadium. So it's very interesting, and it's very good for the sport to have the heavyweight division this rich and this deep.
It is. It obviously doesn't compare to past decades, but it doesn't have to. It doesn't. We don't have to be living in the 60s or anything like that. It just has to. It has to not be awful, and it's definitely kicked up in the last couple of years, and that's appreciated for sure.
Yeah.
Well, that being said, I think we're probably going to go ahead and bring an end to this. But thank you, Bren, and thank you to everybody who tuned in. We always appreciate that. Did I cut out?
No, I got you. I got you now.
Oh, okay, there we go. Okay. Okay. I was going to say thank you, everybody who tuned in live. And Bryn, always a pleasure. We will be, I'm sure, coming back in the next couple weeks or something like that. There's more boxing on. 2017's got more offerings for us, and we'll make the best of it, I guess, right?
And we got Broner Garcia
right
around the corner, which is a super fun fight.
That's right. There's some funk to it. There's some stuff to discuss for sure, but on paper at least, you know, it's got potential. It's got potential.
Definitely.
So everybody, thanks again. If you wouldn't mind, go on to Twitter, follow us there. We appreciate it. Follow Bryn at Brynicio, B-R-I-N-I-C-I-O, me, Patrick Connor, Patrick M. Connor. Go on to Facebook too, if you wouldn't mind. Go on to the Knuckles and Gloves Boxing Radio page, like that. Do all that kind of stuff. Find us on iTunes. Throw us a rating. Moves us up in the rankings. Helps us out. And thanks again. Bryn, I'll talk to you soon, my friend.
You got it. Take care, Patrick.
Take it easy, everybody.